This is Jessie Clegg met Waiting on the Outcome, the 7 minute na 11. En ek het vir Danny Govender hier by my. How are you, Danny?
I'm good, thank you.
So you do biodiversity. What's your title exactly?
So yeah. I'm the general manager for research in Kruger.
Okay, so what does that mean?
So surprisingly, a lot of the listeners might not know, but in national parks, we actually have in-house researchers, scientists that are doing a lot of the biodiversity monitoring and research and informing how we manage the park and informing sort of the larger country policy around conservation of biodiversity.
So what is biodiversity?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It sounds very sort of sciencey and scary.
Yes, I have no idea. We spoke about it just now off air, and I have no idea what you're talking about.
Sure. And I think if you look at it as like it's everything, it's all life on the planet.
Oh, yeah.
And so if we break it up down, we sort of, we've got Hardy Does here too.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So if we break it up, it's like all the genetic diversity that exists on the planet, which then will kind of organize into individual organisms and then bring about all the species diversity we have. And then all those species, how they interact, will actually result in a whole lot of ecosystem diversity. And so how all that life on the planet, the plants, the animals, the bacteria, the fungi, how all of them are interconnected and supporting life is referred to as biodiversity.
So why is it important to have people like you, for example, in the national park?
Sure. So scientists, you know, previously people used to think, you know, you can just get a scientist in and they can come and do a little bit of research and answer a couple of questions. But what we found with having agency scientists, which is what we are agency scientists, we are committed to sand parks, we have long institutional memory, we can build layers of information. So to really answer what are the critical needs and knowledge gaps to better manage the park. The important thing is also about relationships because, you know, a scientist coming in usually doesn't have those strong relationships with the managers and the policymakers, whereas a scientist who works here in the park actually understands what tourism needs to understand about, you know, visitor numbers and what people are doing, what are their preferences, how can we sort of have tourism products cater to different demands, as well as biodiversity. So these scientists will do a range of things, including conservation, biodiversity conservation science, but also tourism science, social science, understanding people, our neighbors, a lot of the sort of integrated water resource management. And I think when it comes to conservation in general, we're a little bit more ahead of the game when it comes to water conservation. Because these are linear connected systems, these rivers start off in Pretoria.
Yes.
You know, just outside of Pretoria, and then they travel all the way down to get to Kruger Park. We know that what we do in Pretoria is going to impact what life is in the river in Kruger Park.
Is there a lot of, because you know, there's a lot of people who live next to the rivers, for example. Is there a lot of pollution that comes through to the Kruger National Park through the rivers, for example?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so that's why we're so ahead in terms of conservation. In about the sort of early 90s, we started really sort of having a much broader view of river conservation. And we started to realize that you can't protect this beautiful A-grade river in the Kruger Park without speaking to all the users of the river and the catchment. Because all of us live in a catchment. We either, you know, live in our residential homes, or we have a little farm, or we have a mine, or we do some sort of industry. And all of these activities ultimately use water. And all of the effluent from those activities makes its way back into that river. So we need to together start to think about what do we do, how can we use less of the resource and conserve it, and also make sure that what we're putting in the river has enough capacity. We call this assimilative capacity of a river, but it's all the microorganisms that are in the river breaking down drugs we put in, breaking down metals we put in, and growing things like vegetation and all of that out of this waste that we produce.
How does it, for example, you spoke about drugs, and I know for a fact, because I lived next to a dam, there was at one stage a lot of estrogen, for example, in the water, and they had some other chemicals as well. How does that influence the animals, for example, in the Kruger National Park, when we, for example, put drugs and stuff into the rivers?
So the important second thing is, and this is why we can't outstrip the ability of that river to really digest all of those chemicals, because a lot of these chemicals, they have a short half-life. So they won't persist for long. They get broken down by the sunlight. They disappear from the system, and then the organisms themselves can break them down. But if we overwork that river, you know, really put a lot of drugs in, then those microorganisms can't break it down anymore. And then we start consuming that levels of estrogen, which then causes what we called feminization of a lot of organisms. So like we get sort of estrogen impacts in humans where you can get feminization, you get very similar things. You know, there have been studies looking at snails, and even in sort of male snails, you start seeing differences in sexual reproductive organs as the levels of estrogen get higher. So really important about, you know, and that's what really we're here for, is even though our role is here in Kruger Park and we're studying the sort of ecosystem and all its complexity, we're actually wanting to sort of really influence how people live and make decisions everywhere. Because biodiversity conservation is not what happens in Kruger Park, it's what happens everywhere. Mm.
Is there something really interesting, like something in the national park that you don't get anywhere else in the world, for example, if you talk about organisms and those kind of things?
So this is why we have protected areas, is we're discovering all the time. And even though we sort of know roughly what large megafauna we have, we don't fully know what different fungi and bacteria we have.
Exactly, yeah.
So when we start thinking about, you know, the biotechnology sort of world is really looking at what microbes we have to digest cellulose. So when we want to sort of create alcohol digesters, where, you know, we're going to end up using biofuels a lot more in the future, we need to be really efficient about how do we convert that starch and that cellulose into combustible material, so like alcohol. And so they're using now, you know, we've had researchers actually look at the gut flora of dung beetles and the gut flora of elephants to see, because an elephant is consuming so much food. He eats for about 23 hours or 22 hours of the day. He's eating a lot. He's got a very inefficient gut. So his gut flora is not really doing a whole lot to digest the cellulose. He's eating a little bit of that vegetation. He's digesting some of it, but a lot of it is then released into the environment. And then all sorts of bacteria and fungi colonize that dung heap and then start digesting it quite quickly. And so if we start to understand what bacteria exists there and what fungi, we can help to sort of create better cellulose digesting fermentation tanks, etc., so that we can at least we can benefit from it in the longer term. So I think this is what having protected areas allows for you. It allows for you to have this little vault of information and organisms that you can tap into, because there's been 4 billion years of evolution in nature, right?
Yeah.
And we're just here for 200,000 years, the whole of human existence. So we can learn so much from nature, and we're just tapping into that now.
Something that a lot of people don't know is, for example, the work you guys do actually comes to, for example, medicines and those kind of things. Is there those kind of things that you guys develop or find out with your fungi and your organisms that actually help us as humans, like normal humans, to do our normal thing?
Sure. We've got a really exciting program around medicinal plants, for instance. And that's really interesting because it's tapping into, I think we always think about science and research as it's only for those guys in the white lab coats. But actually what we start to realize is that there's a lot of indigenous knowledge holders actually just around here. You know, people have lived in these environments for a long time. They know which plants to use. They know what they can use it for, to treat what ailments. And so what we started to realize is that one of these trees, called the pepper bark tree, is something that's used quite widely in traditional medicine, but it's not commonly available outside. And so we were getting a lot of poaching of these trees inside the park. We've got one area where they grow really well, and they were being poached and stripped of their bark. And so we ran a big plant conservation program around pepper bark, where we worked with traditional healers, and we started propagating these trees. We worked with the ARC and the botanical gardens, and we started propagating little seedlings of these trees. We then sort of worked with the traditional healers around alternative tissue use so that they could start using now not the bark, because young trees won't survive if you've stripped all their bark off them, but they will survive if you use a more sustainable part of them, which are their leaves. So we started then with education and awareness around alternative tissue use and then distribution. And so we've distributed thousands of plants around this area. And now these plants are really, they've taken up, they've grown really big, and traditional healers are using them. There's also some research into the pharmaceutical agent in active agent, to see what it is. And they find that it really is an incredible powerful sort of medicine against flus and colds. And a lot of the traditional healers used it during COVID as well, because it's got very good expectorant properties. So instead of ACC 200, you can just use some pepper bark.
I never knew that. Is there other plants that you can, for example, use for?
Sure, there's lots. And as we sort of develop, so everything like wild ginger, there is...
The African potato.
African potato, there's many, and as we start working with traditional healers, we start to also understand, and this is really what conservation is about, right? It's sort of to understand what are plants that are no longer there, and so they no longer have access to this, and how can we then go and source seeds sustainably, or source plants, propagate it, and make sure that people still have access to these remedies.
Is there any way we can, for example, read about more about this and more about what you guys do? Is there a website or something?
If you go onto our Sandparks website, you'll see a link to scientific services, and we've got a really nice, quite user-friendly website where you can go and read blogs, and we publish annual research report each year.
Ooh, that's amazing. I'm going to
highlighting all the research we do. So, yeah,
that's so interesting. I'm definitely going to go read that. Thank you very much for being here, Danny. I hope you guys, you guys do wonderful work, and I hope all the best for you and your way forward.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.